watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In the past week, Bush and his cronies have been touring the country to justify their domestic spying program. Bipartisan calls from a despicable Congress to retroactively legalize their crimes are being spun out to us by a craven media. And the Senate gets ready to vote on the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice who favors a national security dictatorship. Meanwhile, four beloved people from our community have been carted off to federal prison for what was, in real terms, a small protest against an illegal war started by those same officials, resulting in monumental carnage. This week on the program, you'll hear from a variety of voices what the actual state of the union is, and hopefully be called to action to change it. I'd like to begin by reading you the sentencing statement of Teresa Grady, one of the four imprisoned peace activists known as the St. Patrick's Day Four, who poured their blood in a military recruiting center in Lansing, New York in 2003. The four were sentenced last week by one federal judge, John McAvoy, to terms of 4 to 6 months in federal prison. Last Friday in federal court in Binghamton, Teresa Grady said, "Judge McAvoy, I would like to acknowledge and thank you for your leniency with respect to Peter's special concern. Throughout the trial, I have seen your humanity peek through the structures of your office. You are one more reason for my hope in humanity and the goodness in all. That being said, I have been saddened by your initial decision to ignore Article 6, Section 2 of the Constitution of this great nation, which you so often reminded us you were sworn to uphold. This basically denied us the right to defend ourselves of the charge of entering the military site for unlawful purposes. We were trying to uphold international laws on March 17, 2003, which demand citizens avert the great crimes of their government. This court and the jury were intended to be a check and balance to tyrannical government. You instead have sentenced our nation, its young in particular, to continue trammeling international laws, which our own nation has fought for, helped to create, and uphold in the woefully neglected Constitution, leaving us a nation fearful to do anything about the great crimes of our government, of which our souls, both collectively and individually, are sorely aching, not to mention the victims of its violations. Your decision that the necessity and justification defenses were not to be used by the defendants was a preempting of the jury's ability to hear our case. So, yes, justice was denied us in your courtroom and makes the weight of the jury's verdict questionable at best. In response to Miroslav's suggestion, Miroslav is the prosecutor, though peaceful in nature and no threat to the public by actions of our own, Miroslav suggests that we, quote, march to a different drummer, calling us arrogant, and that we think ourselves above the law. I suppose he feels the same of the 9 jurors who voted to acquit us on damage to property in our state trial for the same action. Though the jurors may not have agreed with our method, those 9 average citizens concluded that we held a reasonable belief in the demand of international laws to compel citizens to act to avert the great crimes of their government, resulting in their votes to acquit. I might add here that one of those nine was a World War II veteran who had seen combat and paid attention to the laws which were created as a result of the conflicts with Germany and Japan. He said he fought for the right for us to do what we did and was the first to vote for acquittal. I suppose Miroslav thinks he, too, is arrogant. I will always act believing in the goodness of all people and the gravitation of people's conscience toward rightness, justice, and truth. This courtroom has been no exception in this application. Please go forward with your good conscience and employ the dusty laws which sit unused in the books. They are crying to be used in the name of justice. The victims of war will applaud you. They are the victims of torture, the victims who are our service people and their families, the economic victims of our nation, in particular those displaced by Hurricane Katrina, and the poor who sorely need better education. That all being said, no measure of punishment could change the rightness of the act of March 17, 2003, to call people to conversion of heart and mind away from a great national tragedy. My heart is at peace in that my actions were in concert with the millions of people of our nation who protested this war. What human being would sit silently listening to the screams of a child who is being bludgeoned to death and do nothing? The people of Iraq were and are being bludgeoned by our policies. God forgive us and have mercy on us all. Whenever you have done the right thing, you have won. Those the words of Teresa Grady of Ithaca, New York, at her sentencing last Friday. There is a small thing that we can do that will make a difference. The four sentenced activists, Danny, Claire, Peter, and Teresa, are all parents and breadwinners who live close to the edge financially at the best of times. They have risked prison for us. We must care for their families, for them. To find out how, visit www.stpatricksfour.org. That's stpatricksfour.org. We turn now to renowned human rights lawyer Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He spoke last weekend at the People's Tribunal on Crimes Against Humanity by the U.S. government in New York City.
In April 1967, this is the place, this church, where Martin Luther King openly and notoriously, I should say, opposed the war in Vietnam. The speech was called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence. It's a historic place for that reason, and he began that speech with these words: "A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam." And then in that speech, he lays out a 5-point program. But the ultimate point of the program was remove all foreign troops from Vietnam. Incredibly, even though it was Martin Luther King saying that in 1967, it took 9 more years, millions of Vietnamese deaths and thousands of American deaths to do so. We today model our conduct on that of Dr. Martin Luther King. As he said then, we say today, a time comes when silence is betrayal. A people's trial, a people's commission, is not without important precedents. Almost 40 years ago, in 1968, there was another people's trial. Bertrand Russell, the famous English philosopher, was one of the key participants in that trial. In fact, it was called the Russell War Crimes Tribunal. Russell opened that trial, and here is what he said. "We meet at an alarming time. Overwhelming evidence besieges us daily of crimes without precedent. We investigate in order to expose. We document in order to indict. We arouse consciousness in order to create mass resistance." And so, as Russell said then, we say today, we are putting the Bush administration on trial. We investigate in order to expose. We document in order to indict. We arouse consciousness in order to create mass resistance. We want this trial to be a step in the building of mass resistance to war, to torture, to the destruction of our earth and its people. It's a serious moment. Our country and our world are at a tipping point, tipping toward permanent war, the end of human rights, and the impoverishment and death of millions. We still have a chance, an opportunity to stop this slide into chaos. But it is up to us. We must not sit with our arms folded. We must be as radical as the reality we are facing. We, particularly the American people, have not heard or seen the truth. And if some do, in their comfort and complacency, they often turn away. The truth is hidden. It is hidden through cover-up language, euphemisms, legalisms, obfuscations, false investigations, the blaming of low-level individuals, all meant to hide the reality of the criminal involvement of high officials of this administration, the criminal involvement in war, torture, global and human destruction. Let's take a look at a few of these examples, and there are many. The failure in this country, in the media, by pundits, everywhere we look, to look at the reality. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the first example, the war in Iraq. Supposedly, the war was to eliminate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Now it is said that was a mistake. It was bad intelligence. The administration says it, and much of Congress says it. The press says it. Quote, had we only known, but we thought they had weapons of mass destruction. So we must in the future get better intelligence, as if that explains or excuses why we went to war. But of course, that explanation, the failure of intelligence, and still the current explanation of today by the elites, hides the real reasons for war. It blames some negligent officials, individuals at the CIA for leading us into war. All we need to do, according to them, is correct that, and we won't be in mistaken wars any longer. Mistaken wars will come to an end. If you believe that, you believe in the tooth fairy. We all know that is not the truth. In fact, in 1967, Martin Luther King predicted it. He said, we will be marching and protesting wars for the rest of our lives as long as we are on the wrong side of history. And we are on the wrong side of history. Sometimes I ask myself, why did we progressives know the weapons of mass destruction story was a cover for war, but Congress and the media claimed they did not? Because they, all of them, Democrats, Republicans, the media, they were all reading from the same page. And that page is U.S. world exploitation and domination. And of course, what does the truth tell us about the war in Iraq? It tells us that it's an aggressive war, a crime against peace, and according to the judgment at Nuremberg, that kind of war is the most heinous of all war crimes. I can give you other examples. The fact that they say that we do not torture. All of a sudden, in this country, torture is not torture. Or at worst, it is abuse. And even that abuse is no worse than a fraternity prank. Or if it was abuse, it was because abusive techniques were only for use in Guantanamo. Now, what sense does that make? They can be used in Guantanamo? And somehow they migrated to Iraq. But what does migrated to Iraq mean? Are they birds, like a bird migrates? Without any human agent, torture techniques move from one place to another? Or we are told that it was only a few bad apples, but no responsibilities for the higher up. And yet the media has gone along with this, with these lies and these cover-ups. Even worse, serious media discussion and respectability is given to the legal justifiers. For example, John Yoo, a lawyer for the administration, who wrote that you could torture in the name of national security, much like the Pinochet defense, torture in the name of national security. I was utterly shocked the other day when I pick up the New York Times, and there on the back page, they've asked a half a dozen people, what questions would you ask the potential new Supreme Court Justice Alito? And there they ask John Yoo what questions you would ask him. He was asked to submit his questions. What can you say except they are giving credibility to a man who shouldn't be on the back page of the New York Times, but who should be in the dock facing justice. Let there be no doubt, this administration is engaged in massive violations of the law. Torture is an international crime. It's a grave breach of the Geneva Convention, and almost no one is telling you that. And in this country, it is anathema to do so. A third and last example I want to give you of the hiding of reality, of the blaming of individuals instead of the nature of this country and its leaders, is the example of what happened in New Orleans and Katrina. It's the preparation for and the aftermath of Katrina. What do we hear and read? It was an unpredictable act of God. It was a failure of FEMA. FEMA had a bad manager. All sorts of excuses. Similar to what we heard about the so-called intelligence failures in the Iraq War. But the blame FEMA, the blame the individuals, obscures what we know occurred in New Orleans. What we saw in New Orleans and the Superdome was something very different. It was the legacy of slavery, the legacy of Jim Crow, the legacy of separate but equal. And it was the legacy and the current practice and policy of our country today that human beings are seen as disposable, particularly if they are poor and black. That is the reality of New Orleans, and that is the reality faced every day in this country. The war, torture, and the effects of Katrina are not looked at as failures or the products of the system. The truth is hidden, and by hiding it, we are disempowered. It is not just a few bad apples. It is not just mistakes or bad choices. It is not just bad managers and getting better ones, but something much more fundamental. It's that awful alchemy, as Martin Luther King described it, in this very church, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. I want to say a few words about one aspect of the current period that is extremely frightening, probably the most frightening, although it does have roots in prior administrations. The shorthand for the expression of this period and the scare and the fear that I feel is the king can do no wrong. Or the word might be tyranny, police state, or dictatorship. I recall that after 9/11, in fact, within a few months afterwards, I wrote an article. It was entitled, "Moving Toward a Police State, or Have We Arrived?" And I remember being nervous about it, because this was pretty aggressive to be saying a few months after 9/11. Was I going to get trashed for it? Did it really reflect reality? I wasn't sure. I had some evidence in front of me. I had the Patriot Act. I had internal detentions. I had the president's military order that allows him to pick up people anywhere in the world and detain them in Guantanamo or elsewhere. But I still was willing to say, moving toward a police state, not have we arrived. And a police state to me is one where authority is not under law, where the legislature is overridden, and where our courts are ignored, where one can be jailed without a court proceeding or trial, and where the president, king, or what have you, can do as he pleases, wiretap, torture, and disappear people. Unfortunately, and dangerously, that is the situation we are in today. You are familiar with much of the evidence. There is, however, one piece of important evidence I want to bring to your attention, in which the president, their president, not our president, is open and notorious about his aims, public, if you will. And if you miss it, you have to be an ostrich with your head in the ground. What he has done is basically lay the plan for what has to be called a coup d'etat in America. And it's a small paragraph. And it's contained in what we call a signing statement. It was signed on December 30th, and it's the signing statement to what we call the McCain Amendment. You probably all remember the McCain Amendment, that's the amendment that prohibits cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, or supposedly prohibits it. The president, as you recall, resisted the McCain Amendment, but in the end he had to sign it because it was part of a broader military authorization to pay for what we're doing in Iraq. And when the president signs legislation, he sometimes, and more recently with President Bush, issues a signing statement as to what his understanding of the law is. The president's statement on McCain is only one short paragraph. but it's historic, it's unprecedented, and if you're looking for the grab for power that allows you, permits you, compels you to call this a tyranny, it is that paragraph. It makes 3 points, and I'll paraphrase them. First, speaking as the president, my authority as commander-in-chief allows me to do whatever I think is necessary in the war on terror, including use torture. Second, the commander-in-chief cannot be checked by Congress. Third, the commander-in-chief cannot be checked by the courts. There it is. There you have it. That boring stuff I learned as a junior high school student about checks and balances, or about limited law, or about authority under law, out the window, gone. In other words, the republic and the democracy is over. In Germany, what did they call that? They called that the Führer's law. Why? Because the Führer was the law. That's what George Bush is saying here. George Bush is the law. This assertion of power is so blatant, so open, and so notorious that it finally is shocking some people, such as former Vice President Gore, to speak up. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with what he said in his recent speech on Martin Luther King's birthday. Quote, "The President of the United States has been breaking the law repeatedly and persistently." He was referring to the NSA spying scandal. And then he went on to say, "A president who breaks the law is a threat to the very structure of our government." And then he said, "An executive who acts free from the will of Congress, as this president says he can, or the check of the judiciary, as this president says he can, becomes the central threat that the founders sought to nullify in the Constitution." And then he quotes James Madison to the effect that what President Bush has done is the very definition of tyranny. So there you have it. It's not just us, it's not just progressives, but even someone like former Vice President Gore is saying it, the very definition of tyranny. I believe that the president and this grab for power will be repudiated, but it will not just happen. The pendulum does not swing back automatically. It will take an aroused public and an aroused people. And so the question is really, where do we go from here? One place I can tell you not to go is don't go to the Democrats in Washington. I have to tell you, I have never in my life been kicked in the teeth so badly as I was on the Guantanamo cases when we took that to the Democrats in Washington. And I'm just going to say it here. There's a million reasons I can tell you don't go there, but this one is called the Graham-Levin bill. And after we win the right to go to court for the detainees at Guantanamo, and we win that in the Supreme Court, Republican Senator Graham and Democrat Senator Levin get together, and what do they decide to do a few weeks ago but strip the courts of any jurisdiction to hear the Guantanamo cases? That's what they do, Democrats and Republicans together. And then they say you can use evidence from torture to keep those people in jail, kicking us right in the teeth, kicking the courts in the teeth. And so if you think that we are going to get far by going there, you've got it wrong. Lessons of history teach us that we don't move our leaders, without the passion and the protest of the people. I want to close with a sense of hope. It's been a rough 4 years. It's been a rough 20 years. It's been a rough 40 years since Dr. King spoke. But I want to close with a sense of hope. This administration is unraveling. There's a split in the elites. Gore is one of the best examples. Everywhere we see former administration officials speaking out. They realize the administration has gone too far. They want to save some remnant of democracy. We see indictments from Scooter Libby to DeLay coming fast and furious. We see General Miller, responsible for torture in Guantanamo and Iraq, taking the Fifth Amendment, essentially, so he won't have to testify. We see General Sanchez, who is head of troops in Iraq, retiring without that fourth star. It's a real opening for us, but it's not simply to go back to the normal. It's not simply to save a remnant of democracy. The malady is much deeper than that. We need a radical transformation of our society. My hopes for today and for the future is that the truth will arouse resistance. And with resistance, there will be some change. I mean resistance of every sort, mobilizing, protesting, disobeying, and disobedience. And then again, when I was reading Dr. King's speech, the thought that he closed with and that I want to close with is that sometimes we can wait too long to take action. Or as Dr. King said, you can be too late. And we, unless we act, may be too late. So let me end with Dr. King's directive to us all. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. There is such a thing as being too late. We still have a choice today. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. Thank you. We'll do this together.
Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking last weekend in New York City at the People's Tribunal on Crimes Against Humanity by the U.S. government. For more on the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights, visit www.ccr-ny.org. Next, we turn to one of my favorite broadcasters, Tracy James, in Oakland, California, producer and host of Slave Revolt Radio.
You know, the black experience provides a rich resource of the injustices that are served out by the state. And often, when the issues that concern black are ignored by large portions of the population that claim to be engaged in social justice movements, much resource and analysis, fields of attack against this machine often go amiss. We're going to explore this a little bit with Dan Baum, author of the book Smoke and Mirrors, as he goes into a discussion about how this past and current war on drugs, like war on terror, has been a very effective vehicle to create, amongst all other things that the order wants, a form of a free market law enforcement type of apparatus. We're going to tie some of these things together as we go step by step in outlining the aspect of how wars made easy on Sam's plantation. So check this out.
Forfeiture is quite the thing. Forfeiture has created free market law enforcement in the United States. Police now are desperate for funding. The same way state and local school boards and social service agencies have been strapped for funds by the property tax revolution and by federal budget cuts, so have state and local police. The one recourse they have, however, is to seize assets, to confiscate property in drug cases. We should add here that rapists don't lose their property, murderers don't lose their property, people who grow 5 marijuana plants in their basement lose their property. Most state law forbids that. I think California is one. State law forbids police directly benefiting from seized assets. However, since the 80s, any contact with illegal drugs, with a single marijuana cigarette, can be defined as federal crime. So if the local DA or the local sheriff wants your house and wants to bust you for pot, for example, all he has to do is call the DEA and the U.S. attorney and say, come make this a federal case. Because under federal law, police are entitled to a cut of the assets, even if it violates state law. This is why our federal prison system is exploding, because there's a huge incentive for police to make any drug crime a federal crime. They then get a cut of the asset.
So if you check out what Baum was talking about concerning the war on drugs apparatus and how the cops get a cut out of this and how it further not only empowers the federal apparatus to seize upon the masses of people all in the name of war on drugs, you can see how just in the name of in a war on terrorism, a similar aspect takes place as the wheels of encroachment by the state apparatus grind deeper and deeper into people's lives, and how, once again, in the same way that on various local levels you have police financially benefiting from this war on drugs because they get a cut of the assets that they swoop up, you see that within this whole war on terrorism aspect on a national and global stage, various corporate mechanisms profiting off of this apparatus and enriching themselves. You know, you see many people acting shocked about what's going on under this banner of war on terrorism, when actually it's overlapped with the war on drugs, with the because these wars made easy help further empower the state apparatus. They help further enrich the state apparatus. And it also changes through concepts of definition. So now, just about anyone in the banner of fighting a war on terrorism can be labeled a terrorist suspect. And then who knows what can be done with you. Carted off, you know, for torture or whatever. Carted off somewhere in American gulags or held indefinitely. All in the banner of a war on terrorism as they define it. Well, by the same token, you have a situation where drug crimes, quote unquote, are now redefined as federal crimes. And once that apparatus takes place, a whole nother mechanism steamrolls in with all other forms of state power backing. Because in this society where wars are made easy, the terror of the state, the beast, is what's really truly being unleashed. Now here Baum goes into how 80% of the people who've lost their property have never been convicted or even charged with a crime under this asset forfeiture. Check this out.
There's a great story about a man in Nashville named Willie Jones who owns a nursery and was traveling to Texas to buy shrubbery, and it's a cash business, and he had $9,600 in cash with him and went to the Nashville airport. He pulled that wad of cash out to pay for his ticket. Willie Jones is black. The ticket agent sees a black man with $9,600 in his pocket and assumes he's a drug dealer. At the Nashville airport, the DEA had a program whereby any ticket agent who spots a drug dealer gets a 10% cut of any money seized or any asset seized. She calls the DEA, they put him against a wall, they take his money away without arresting him, without charging him with a crime, without convicting him of a crime, give him a receipt for an unspecified quantity of cash, and it took him years to get that money back, and he didn't get it all back. They just took it. They later claimed that a dog barked when the dog sniffed it, saying that the money was tainted with cocaine. The Pittsburgh Press, which originally broke this story, did a smart thing. They withdrew cash from Federal Reserve banks all over the country, had it tested for cocaine, and found that 96% of the cash in the United States contains microscopic traces of cocaine, which means all the money in the United States is legally seizable. You take the cash out of William Bennett's pocket and put it in front of a drug dog, and the dog will bark. The DEA seizes this money, and then when it does, it doesn't clean the money, it doesn't destroy the money, it puts it in the bank to be seized again.
Now, once again, you can see how cynical, how diabolical this whole mechanism is. But without any kind of serious attack on what the state has been doing under the banner of a war on drugs for years, you can see the overlapping corrosion of rights. So here's someone who, Willie Jones, who deals in a cash business, takes out some cash just to pay for a damn airline ticket. Now you have a situation where it's an embedded snitch type culture, just like in the war on terrorism. Slave listeners have heard me play that little speech where they're trying to get people, do you know a terrorist? You know, that type of thing, where they want you to come in or call in about anything that you see suspect around, because this may be a possible terrorist. Now, within the war on drugs, for years they've had this apparatus set up, but they've also making it give people an incentive. So this person who, this cash attendant at the airlines, sees this black man with a wad of cash, calls the DEA. She gets 10% of the cut. The DEA takes his money. They don't even charge him with anything. They just take the money. So you have, just like within a war on terrorism, which is another aspect of the war by the state, which is just another aspect of war is made easy, a snitch society, your rights, your basic rights are being stripped away. Now, when many people look shocked about what's going on now in this current state of the war on terrorism, this has been happening for years, primarily to black people under the banner of a war on drugs, the state apparatus controlling stuff. Now, in the same way that Willie Jones found himself assumed to be a drug dealer, recently an article's come out where it goes, 4-year-old boy on government no-fly list. Edward Island's reaction to being on the government's quote-unquote no-fly list should have been the tip-off that he is no terrorist. Quote, I don't want to be on the list. I want to fly and see my grandma, unquote, the 4-year-old boy said, according to his mother, Sojia Allen, and her son had trouble boarding planes last month because someone with the same name as Edward is on the government's terrorist watch list. She said it took several minutes of pleading and a phone call by the ticket agent to get on the plane to New York. But later on, they found even more trouble trying to board planes and stuff. I mean, this shows how sick this whole aspect is. But in the same way that Willie Jones had his basic due processing rights kicked to the curb under the vehicle of a war on drugs, this war on terrorism, this watch list and all of this type of stuff, with this whole beast eye apparatus looking and having people look over their every shoulder, is further eroding our basic lives. Because in the name of these wars by the empire, wars made easy is also a construct that war for them is a vehicle for them to more easily control us physically, economically, psychologically, socially, politically. Now here Baum goes into how this seizure process has evolved. Let's check this out.
Happens slowly. Civil forfeiture, the idea that the police can take property that is offensive to the law without due process, is a long-standing, with the first Continental Congress passed a law like that, having to do with slave ships. That means they could take property that is dangerous or offensive to the law, even if the owner is not present. A bank robber's gun, during Prohibition, barrels of whiskey. Stuff that is obviously dangerous, offensive to the law, can be taken. Then there's criminal forfeiture, which grows out of the RICO laws in the 70s, in which losing your property is a part of the punishment. If you're convicted of a crime, you can lose your property. And that was extended so that if you, let's say, are organized crime and you then invest your ill-gotten gains in a legitimate business, the legitimate business could be seized. Was beginning in Jimmy Carter's presidency. This is not something we can necessarily thank just conservative Republicans for. Beginning in Jimmy Carter's presidency, the two types of forfeiture began to be blended. The low standard of proof in civil forfeiture met the extended reach of criminal forfeiture. And we now have a situation where, as you say, on mere suspicion, police can seize your house, your bank account, the money in your pocket, your car, if they tell a judge, we believe this to be ill-gotten gains. You can then sue them to get your money back, but that is at your expense, you initiating the procedure.
So once again, this is why I constantly remind slaves to not let up on the Democratic Party. These guys just hand the baton off from one administration to another and then just have a joint slave ship auctioning sales of us and our rights in Congress and in Senate. That's all that's going on there. These are just auctioning sinners, for our basic humanity, internally in this country and externally on this global plantation. Now here, the civil forfeiture aspect was developed by these merchants of death, and then the criminal aspect expanded, you know, through the RICO law and all of that. But during whose administration? Democrat Jimmy Carter. They merged the low standard of civil forfeiture and extended it with the criminal forfeiture. And now it's blossomed into, and this has been going on for years, where a pig, without even charging you, can go running up to the judge and start stripping you of your house, your bank account, under allegation of you being locked within the drug world. You know, you a participant selling drugs. So here you have the expansion, once again, of the whole state apparatus over people's basic rights without any due process. And if you want to fight that, you don't have a right to counsel, because they're not charging you personally. They're charging your property under the whole asset forfeiture. But if they frozen or seized your bank account and your house, your car, your other means of survival, then how can you even go against them from a standpoint of getting a lawyer, unless you have resources outside of yourself, you know, friends, family members, and all of that type of stuff. But that would then further increase the strain and stress that you're under. But see, these guys have used this apparatus for years. This is nothing new that they've done. And you can see how this same type of encroachment on our basic rights has overlapped with the war on terror apparatus, because for the empire, these are all wars made easy. Now here, Dan Baum goes into how the LA Sheriff's Department plotted to seize a man's property under the banner of a war on drugs, where, as we know, these are all different forms of wars by the empire made easy.
Detective decided that he was going to get this ranch, basically. This was in the opinion of the Ventura County DA, who later investigated this. They ended up killing the man. They ended up killing a 61-year-old millionaire who was living on his ranch because, in a huge drug raid looking for marijuana plants that never existed, the man was completely innocent, and he ended up dead. He beat down his door at dawn, right, and he, thinking somebody was coming in his house to kill him, walked into his hallway with a gun, and the sheriff's deputy involved shot him and killed him. Again, when he investigated, the Ventura County DA concluded that it was all about a desire to seize the ranch. No, it is very rare that police are prosecuted. The court has gone along with this every step of the way. Just this week, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that it is illegal for police to completely search a car for drugs, even if the original stop was only for a traffic violation, even in cases where the police were obviously making the traffic stop because they wanted to search the car for drugs. This was a case that involved two black men in a car, and the police wanted to search the car of two black men.
And once again, you can see how this parallels the searching aspect of people who look quote-unquote Mideastern to them, or are of Arab descent, and how in the same way that the courts, and they went through this whole process, you know, starting in the 90s, the mid-90s, allowing them to have the power to search people's cars for drugs, even though that's the only reason why they stopped them, and they didn't have any justifiable reason on stopping them in the first place, other than they wanted to search their car. No due process, nothing. But under this whole war on drugs mantra, just like in this war on terrorism mantra, the rights are stripped away, the courts in power, the police apparatus, to further increase their leverage against the masses of people. Now, what's also fascinating is that you have a situation where, you know, concerning this rancher who ended up being killed, how it initially started was they wanted the ranch because they just wanted the ranch for economic reasons and so on and so forth. And they knew that if they used the apparatus, the whole mechanism of seizing the property under the banner of war on drugs, they would get a cut. So a cop flying over in a helicopter claimed that he saw marijuana plant, not even growing from the ground of this guy, but hanging on a tree. Under that, they were able to go in after this guy's property. They do it in the middle of the night, like Bomb talks about. This guy has no idea what's going on. He thinks people are breaking into his house, which they were. It was cops breaking into his house. He gets his gun, they shoot him and kill him, so on and so forth. So here you have this individual killed under this war on a drugs vehicle. The way that the population is labeled a suspect in their assets, even though we know there's other motives involved, it's the same way that within the context of the war on terrorism, the state has been able to plunge its way into other people's territories, like Iraq, under the banner of wanting to fight a war on terrorism, quote unquote. But we know that just like in the sheriff's department, there were other ulterior motives being vacillated out. Well, within the U.S. imperial context, there are obviously other imperial motives, oil. But they use the context of a war on terrorism to justify their confiscation of other people's property, their oil, their resources, for their own further enrichment and control. In the same way that the sheriff's department, under the banner of war on drugs, used the war on drugs construct to seize and goose-step their way into this person's property for their own personal enrichment. And since their enrichment for all of these structures is tied in to the obliteration of other people's basic human rights, you can see how, for once again, the war, these wars made easy, is something that the state apparatus easily slips into. From these little wretched cops to Halliburton to Big Oil to the philosophies of the neocon, which is tied into the whole imperial structure. They may use different terms: war on drugs, war on crime, war on guns. It's just a war on us. But unless we assess how overall this mechanism is working, these will continue to be wars made easy. Now, Baum now goes into what is the drug dealer profile. You know, we know of the quote-unquote profile of the terrorist suspect. Well, long before the terrorist suspect was created in the name of a war on terror, let's check out the drug dealer's profile.
It's young black men. I mean, let's not forget that a third of the young black men in this country are under some form of correctional control, jail, prison, probation, or parole. We've criminalized an entire generation of black men. What that tells their children, I can only shudder to think. There's a great bit in the book. The University of Virginia Law School totaled up, made a list of all of the drug courier profile cases that the DEA had made, and to write down the characteristics that the DEA had claimed indicated to them that this person was a drug dealer when they stopped him or her in the airport. And they included deplaning from the middle of the plane, deplaning from the front of the plane, deplaning from the back of the plane, walking fast to the terminal, walking slowly through the terminal, walking at average speed through the terminal, appearing nervous, appearing calm. In other words, anybody. Black male is the most dangerous thing to be. I mean, the L.A. County the L.A. Police Department during the 1980s arrested at one time or another three-quarters of all the black men in L.A. between 16 and 35. That's three-quarters of all of them. That includes the police officers. That includes the stockbrokers. That includes the choir boys. That's everybody. At one time or another, If you're a black man and you lived in L.A., you have a 75% chance that you spent some time in the L.A. County lockup. And African Americans understand this. This has been largely a war on African Americans, and it has been since Nixon. And I've got to add this. I interviewed 175 people to do this book, starting with John Ehrlichman, coming right up through to the Clinton. And they astounded me with their candor at how explicitly they understood this to be a political construct from the start. This has never been about protecting the public health from potentially dangerous substances. And the drug czars and the people who worked for the drug czars and the various people who worked on Capitol Hill, for whom we have to thank for this drug policy, told me that in their words. This is not me divining their motives and reading between the lines and reading into what they might have said. They were extremely explicit. John Ehrlichman said to me, we knew we could not make it illegal to be young or poor or black in the United States, but we could criminalize their common pleasure. This has been political from the start.
Here you have it once again, how this whole mechanism truly works out. When you have a situation where the DEA's profile for a drug suspect is one, basically being black, but leaving from the middle of the plane, front of the plane, back of the plane, walking fast, slow, average speed, appearing nervous, appearing calm. It makes it so clear what this is all about and how they further target and demonize a particular population, condition the overall population to accept this, to further erode the overall rights of the masses of people. So in the same way that currently they are now using this vehicle within the war on terror on Mideast, South Asian, quote-unquote, looking people, it's the same way that they've long instituted this against the black population. And when, as Baum points out, we're in L.A., you had at a point where three-fourths of all black males found themselves under the cage, the iron cage of the beast, then that's more than clear, or should be, what's going on. As been noted, this from war on drugs to war on terrorism is a political construct, and it has been, like the war on drugs, a political construct from the beginning. Here you have Ehrlichman talking about we couldn't make it illegal to be young, poor, and black, but we could criminalize their common pleasure. Once again, you have a situation where the war on terrorism is a political construct. And in the same way that Baum talked about how the war on drugs is not to protect the public health, neither is the war on terrorism. This is the state using all of its diabolical apparatus to terrorize the masses. But since there has historically been so little willingness to accept the hardcore racist economic political attack that has been happening towards black people and insert it into a real dialogue of an understanding of what this machine truly represents and how, yes, the Democrats and Republicans play a pivotal role in administering this, you have people now acting shocked under this banner of war on terrorism when it's obvious to see a core part of its roots have been sprouting up within the forms of the war on drugs. But once again, so much of the social justice movement is in such a denial and hates to confront the racist apparatus that is at the core of this economic machine order. You can't look at the construct of whiteness as this some kind of cultural thing. Whiteness is in itself is a political, social, and economic construct to maintain economic, social, political order and control. So those ruling circles within that position use that political apparatus to maintain the vision and the social apparatus that they see fit. And an important construct to that is having a war on black folks and using that to further isolate that pivotal community and also the masses of people who are in the servant and slave class throughout this country. Now, next, Baum goes into Nixon's drug strategy and how, just like in war on terrorism, you can play basically the fear factor game, the script, to traumatize the dumps in America to do what the rulers want and have them give up what they don't even know they have a right to. So check this out.
So, you know, the Nixon White House had this shorthand, as it was explained to me by several people who worked there, the young, the poor, and the black. That's how they used to define everybody else who was not their constituency. And Nixon's Law and Order campaign in 68 and then staying in the White House depended on mobilizing white middle-class resentment against the anti-war left and blacks in the inner cities. I mean, you got to remember in the context, it appeared to frightened white middle-class people that the country was coming unglued. If you watch TV then, and I went back doing this book and watched old television, you know, evening news shows, and, you know, first there was a scene from Columbia University with riot sticks and tear gas and police, and then you switched, and then they would go to downtown Dayton, Ohio, and it was the same thing, you know, riot sticks and tear gas and police, and it really did appear that the country was coming apart, and people were very frightened by that. Nixon won the White House by capitalizing on that fear, and he held the White House by capitalizing on that fear, and drugs were a convenient code for hippies who smoked pot and blacks who used heroin, and it was a way to get at these populations. I had a marvelous stroke of luck in that Bob Haldeman's diary was published right while I was doing the research for this book. And there's a marvelous line in there in which Haldeman records, quote, President Nixon emphasized that the whole problem in this country is really the blacks, and the trick will be finding a way to blame them for everything without appearing to do so.
Now, it can't get much rawer and more apparent than that. Here you have a situation where Nixon's strategy that he actually inherited from, Strom Thurmond, part of the Southern strategy, was to divide part of the base of the Democrat and to help regiment large portions of the white population into identifying with their whiteness as opposed to the class affiliations with the masses of black people and youth at the time during the 60s who were involved in, anti-war campaigns, so on and so forth. So the young, the poor, and the black construct was developed. And and to make them look like alien outsiders who are corroding the whole fabric of the American society. So they play this little nationalistic card, which the American population is so willing to do, especially when you wave the banner of a war. So the analysis of during that time, how Sam was already engaged in a war, that being a war against the Vietnamese people, is not critiqued by elements within this society in the way it should have been, you know, as an imperial war. Of course, many people ended up being against it, but that, a lot of that had to do with them getting their ass shot off or their sons getting their ass shot off. But here, they go into the next stage of the war. And they had already been in some other wars, which was a war on a population of black folks through a spatial deconcentration, you know, of the communities and all of that. But they used this drug war aspect under the banner of law and order and all of that other type of stuff. And here Haldeman, a partner of Nixon, what did Haldeman himself say was their real motivation? Just like we went over about their motivation in other aspects of the war, the sheriff's department and the seizure of the house and big oil and others and the seizure of Iraqi's oil field. Haldeman on Nixon said, quote, President Nixon emphasized that the whole problem in this country is really the blacks, and the trick will be finding a way to blame them for everything without appearing to do so, unquote.